Hey, folks, welcome to part two of episode 19. I'm Dan Brady.
I'm Johnny Smith. I tell you what, Dan, I really enjoyed last week's episode. What are we diving into this week?
Today we are talking about the pagan influences on Santa Claus and then the modern induction of Santa Claus into American history.
I know a little bit about the pagans, and I'm just going to go off and say I refuse to say anything bad about them.
that's a brilliant choice, Johnny. So part one, we talked about, you know, Saint Nicholas and the some of his folklore transferring to the Santa Claus folklore, and just, you know, a lot of that stuff. Today we again are talking about the influences of Odin and Sinterklaas on modern Santa. Plus, we're going to talk about a couple of key moments in Santa's timeline in American history.
Okay, and for all the Office fans out there, I'm going to at least mention Bell Schnickel at least one time for you folks. We didn't forget about him.
I did. Never really got into the Office.
Well, sir, you are doing yourself a large disservice.
Hey, man, I
skip
can't
season
help
one. Skip season one. Go right to season two. Start from there. Great show. Hilarious. Character development. Top notch.
I will check it out when you start watching my recommendations, Johnny.
All right. So I understand your stance on The Office now.
Has our friendship changed?
I don't think so. I'm like, Dan, hey, watch this funny, hilarious stuff. Dan's like, okay, only if you watch this sad, depressing stuff that sees how people suffered through war and combat.
Hey, man, I think
Dan's like, hey, man, I'm having a rough day. I'm a little depressed. Well, what have you been watching all day, Dan? War documentaries. Well, that's probably part of the goddamn reason.
Hey, man, if somebody else picked up their slack on this podcast, I wouldn't have to watch so much.
The problem is it bleeds into his normal life, because I'll ask him, Dan, how are you? You say, oh, it's been a fortnight since I've seen my beloved. And I'm like, Dan, nobody talks like that shit anymore. Come back to modern times. Use FaceTime. Call somebody.
Wow. That was like borderline hack, but I'll allow it. Good job, Johnny.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So anyway, before we start trading blows here on What in the History, let's get into today's subject.
So, yes, absolutely. I'm excited.
As I mentioned, a lot of the influences on Santa Claus, or at least what we know Santa as today, can be traced back to Nordic lore and paganism. Amongst the Norse
This may be a bit further than the research for the podcast, but do you have a brief definition of paganism? Because I know that word's thrown around quite a bit.
Not in front of me, but you know what, Johnny? I got you.
Yeah, we have the power of research at our hands.
Paganism was originally a derogatory term for polytheism, implying its inferiority. Paganism has broadly connotated the religion of the peasantry after the Middle Ages. The term paganism was applied to any unfamiliar religion, and the term presumed a belief in false gods.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because paganism isn't some general religion. It was simply a slur, right, for any smaller religion that was different from what the mainstream practiced. Okay, so we're not talking specifically about like an organized religion. It was just a blanket name given to poor people.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Basically, anything for Christians to look down their nose at.
Which, thank God, it's been a while, but they've overturned it. Christians never do that anymore. It's beautiful.
Oh, man. So, Amongst the Norse gods, it was Odin who reigned supreme. Though mostly associated with death and healing, he also presided over the fields of war, royalty, knowledge, and poetry. First and foremost, Odin was a descendant of the old Germanic god of wind and the dearly departed. Boy, that's a little poetic, isn't it?
It's kind of beautiful. Maybe that saying, like, where did someone go when they disappeared? Into the wind is where that came from. Like, hey, where's John? I don't know. He's in the wind.
Maybe. I mean, all we are is just dust in the wind, Johnny. Just dust in the wind.
I'm just spending my time podcasting while I'm here for this short period.
So he was always attached to his female equivalent known as Freya. As told by Nordic lore, Odin was the father of Thor, Baldur, and he was described as deeply spiritual and brimming with wisdom, yet notoriously fickle.
Really?
Odin was
an older, powerful man. That's
Sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Could you imagine Thor looking at Odin and being like, "Okay, boomer"?
Well, he I could see him being fickle when he takes away the hammer. He's like, "Oh, you're not worthy anymore."
Oh man, you shit talking me, son. You can't have this no more.
Yeah, man. Crown's not yours now, bitch.
Odin was the central celebratory figure of the ancient Yule, which was a festive holiday that took place in the midst of winter, usually coinciding with the winter solstice on the 21st of December. Like the modern day Santa Claus, Odin was a seemingly all-knowing deity, both revered and feared by children across Viking territories, particularly during the season, for he showered joy upon the well-behaved and inflicted misery upon the disobedient.
Okay, so he was just like the powerful god.
So, kind of like Old Testament Christmas figure here. Like, you know, if you're good, you're going to be rewarded, but if you're bad, you are going to be struck down. When diving deeper into the significance of Odin at Yule time, his connections to his contemporary counterpart become even more apparent. Odin delivered gifts and discipline not on a plush red sleigh bordered in gold, but on the back of his prize flying stallion, a magnificent eight-legged beast.
I like Odin, that image of Daddy Claus.
Daddy Claus. Oh, yeah, I like it. Red tank top, you know, gray beard. So Odin was supposedly accompanied by a pair of talking ravens who served as loyal pets and spies. Odin, the Vikings believed, watched over each and every one of his charges throughout the year, and come Yule, one would be presented with the results of Odin's assessments. In other words, he knows if one has been bad or good, so it'll be good for Odin's sake.
Okay. So a little big brother tack.
Yeah. So obedient children look forward to Odin's visits. The children stuff their boots with straws, carrot sticks, or other root vegetables for the horse, and place them carefully by the hearse. So now we got kind of the origin of where the cookies come from. And place them carefully by their hearth, just as children today prepare plates of freshly baked cookies and a cold glass of milk. The straw-filled boots, though I will say, I saw a line in one of the books I read, kind of creeped me out. Kids would prepare delicious treats and a glass of milk for their midnight visitor. That just sounds like the dark pages of Pornhub, in my opinion. Mic check. Is this thing on?
Merry Christmas, everybody.
The straw filled boots also may have inspired the Christmas stockings now hung up above indoor fireplaces. Odin crawled up.
Let me stop you. Let me stop you. You said straw-filled boots?
Yes.
Were they supposed to put the straw in the boots?
Yes. It's for, it's to keep them collected for Odin's horse. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Odin would crawl up fire pits and shimmy down the chimneys of Nordic huts and longhouses. Others say he simply materialized. The next morning, children scrambled over to their boots. Those who passed Odin's test squealed with glee, for the straw in their shoes had been replaced with fistfuls of sweets, apples, and little trinkets, among other prizes. Naughty children, however, shrunk away from their boots, whimpering, for in them lay a lone scourge. So,
they got a little bit of disease.
Well, basically, I try to Google this term, like any correlation, you know, with Odin and stuff. And all that came up was like a disease. That's what it was. If you were a naughty kid, Odin just slapped you with plague. Like, how is that not Old Testament?
If you don't behave, Odin is going to give you lupus.
Mom, our presents were coated in anthrax from Odin.
That's harsh, man. You better behave. You know, this is supposed to be an episode about Santa Claus, but it seems like it's going to be an episode more about marketing later on and more about population control.
Well, we're getting past that now. We're going to touch on Sinterklaas very quickly, who's the basically the Dutch embodiment of St. Nicholas. It's based, again, on the historical figure of St. Nicholas, you know, the Greek bishop of Myra. and so he's depicted as an elderly man, an elderly serious man with white hair and a long full beard. He wears a long red cape over a traditional white bishop's garb, like the pointy hat, and sometimes dons a red ruby ring and holds a gold color crosshair, a long ceremonial shepherd's staff with a fancy curled top. He traditionally rides a white horse.
I've ridden a white horse once or twice in my day, and boy, that's a wild ride, guys. I tell you that.
Oh, man.
Parking lot of a Walmart starts out a party, buddy.
Okay. So are you trying to kill this episode too?
Yeah. We're both trying to murder it, apparently. Dan's like, here's how Santa Claus came about. And I'm like, let me tell you about the first time I did coke.
So St. Nicholas first touched down in the New World in the early 17th century alongside the Dutch and German colonists that came to settle in North America. Remember last week on the Silk Road episode where we just talk about ideas and stuff coming together, you know, being transferred from people to people. This is kind of what happens here. Few records have survived from this time, but historians believe that the gift-giving tradition surrounding the magnanimous saint were first practiced by Dutch families, predominantly in New Amsterdam. Any idea where that is?
In New Amsterdam? Any idea where New Amsterdam is?
Yeah, the original colony. Year? This is,
I don't know, Massachusetts.
You've been there, you've performed there, you've performed in two clubs there.
Is it Cleveland,
New Ohio? York City?
Oh, really?
Yeah, man,
I didn't know that
because it's predominantly settled by Dutch immigrants. So, New Amsterdam,
You know what? I've seen almost every type of people in New York City. I don't think I've ever seen a Dutch person.
Well, it's not like they wear their clogs out, you know.
Hey, man, You never know. Have you been to New York City? Have you seen what people wear up there? Clogs would be the least alarming. There was a lady walking around with butterfly wings and a thong taking pictures with people for $10. Clogs would not be out of the realm.
So, German, Belgian, and Polish colonists stationed in Pennsylvania may have also celebrated the feast day of St. Nicholas. On the 23rd of December, 1773, England-born James Rivington's New York Gazetteer published an article covering the Boston Tea Party. This is cool. In it, he mentioned that clans of Dutch families had convened at a local tavern to honor St. Nicholas. Last Monday, the anniversary of St. Nicholas, otherwise called St. A. Claus, was celebrated at Protestant Hall at Mr. Walden's, where a great number of the sons of that ancient saint celebrated the day with great joy and festivity. Rivington was therefore the first to publish an article in North America that mentioned St. Nicholas and his feast day by name. As one can gather, he also made the first reference to Santa Claus, identifying him as St. A. Claus, possibly misspelling of the Dutch Sinterklaas.
Oh, so the spelling issues. Seems like common mistakes is what's forming modern-day Santa. That and the telephone game.
This was from 1773. This was in the same article talking about the Boston Tea Party, Johnny. How cool is that?
Super cool, Dan. Like, to know just like today, there are papers and news sources that will put out shit that's important and shit that's completely irrelevant.
Right. That's a good point.
You know, it's like, hey, the Boston Tea Party's happening. By the way, you guys know about this Dutch fella?
St. Nicholas disappeared from papers and was not again chronicled until 20 years later when his traditions were resurrected by a New Yorker by the name of John Pintard. Pintard, hey, Dan, a merchant. Yes.
Just imagine you're the guy that writes, like, food reviews, and your food review is in the same paper as the day of 9/11. Like, you got all these articles, and then it's like, their tapas weren't as good as I expected from the menu. Well, like,
a lot of albums released on 9/11, and those record sales, like, a lot of good-name bands released albums that day, and their record sales never took off.
Yeah, man. You know, only the greats like Toby Keith can capitalize on 9/11.
It's not about capitalizing on 9/11. No, I'm just saying songs that were released on that day, because Tuesday is a album release day.
You know, I didn't even know that 9/11 happened on a Tuesday, Dan.
Yep.
All right, back to memory lane. You remember where you were?
I was taking a test on World War I history in eighth grade, which I got a 97 out of 100 on.
I was in class paying attention very sporadically to someone trying to teach me something. So it seems like we are both in the same exact fucking spot.
This is a very weird episode to bring this up on. Hey, you know what brings joy to the world? Remembering 9/11.
Hey, you know what else brings joy to the world on a Christmas episode? Some sweet merch up in the store. Link will be in the episode description. Help support the podcast and look fresh doing it. We've got a couple nice designs up there. Check it out at our What in the History merch store.
I'm pretty proud of them. Give them a look. moving on from 9/11. But hey, we have to be commended because we haven't forgotten.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
John Pintard was a merchant, philanthropist, active Freemason, and secretary for the Academy of Fine Arts.
You know, you're saying that name a little strong, a little rough out the tongue. It's almost coming off like some type of insult.
Pintard.
Oh, man, Pintard. It's even worse than you were pronouncing it.
Pintard. How about that? Pintard.
Don't be a Pintard.
I know the first time I said it, I was like, did I just say something bad?
That's what we're going to worry about. Oh, God.
Hey, man. So he hinted at his intrigue with St. Nicholas in his private journal in 1793 and 1797, but it was not until the first years of the 19th century that he took his movement off paper.
So he was a planner.
Basically, he wanted to bring St. Nicholas to American culture and make it a national holiday. He became one of the 11 founders of the New York Historical Society, said to be the first museum in the state. Pinter recognized the importance of stockpiling and preserving journals, eyewitness accounts, books, so on and so forth, and saving them from dust and obscurity. This cynicism of these men had been hardened by their experiences during the American Revolution and a British invasion of New York City in 1776.
Dan, question. Yeah. Do you believe in the preservations of journals and writings like that?
Hell yeah, I do.
Do you keep a journal?
I do not. I should, though. You know what? I will.
I would think you would be the type of fellow that would keep a journal. Not anything crazy, but just even like a historical journal.
I have in the past.
On September 1st, 2020, I stubbed my toe, so I beat my cat.
Hey, man, were you here that day?
I can just guess it. If a veteran's not married, I feel bad for their cat. That's all I'm saying.
You know I take care of Abby.
Yeah. Abby's the biggest cat that will bark at me that I've ever seen.
Right? She's currently curled up on my bed in my jacket right now, snoring into it. So you know where my dog wasn't? She wasn't there when St. Nicholas was unofficially adopted as the society's mascot, a personification of the sweet, uncomplicated days of yesteryear. In 1809, Pintard gave the following toast at the Society's annual dinner celebrations. He said, to the memory of St. Nicholas, may the virtuous habits and simple manners of our Dutch ancestors be not lost in the luxuries and refinements of the present time. So, you know, this kind of still has a modern day feel like, oh, things aren't as good today as they were yesterday. So they're kind of like craving this nostalgia. So they tried to bring St. Nicholas back into society.
Man, I tell you what, first off, that's a weird person to represent you or image to represent you. Just imagine on a sports team, like the starting lineup of the Pittsburgh Santa Clauses. Like, that's really weird.
Right.
And as far as that goes, man, I tell you what, the winter solstice season really has me down, man. Every day I just drive around and I think about times of yesteryear and just how things are never going to be that simple or the same. And it just makes me sad to my core. I just drive anymore and I'll look out the window and I just get sad because things aren't like they used to be.
Right. So,
and not even like before COVID, I'll drive by like a mall and remember like going to the mall when I was like 9 and just how it's a completely different experience. And it just makes me almost shed a tear.
Right. Damn, that was deep, Johnny. So anyway,
hardcore depression.
For sure. 100%.
I'm letting the folks know out there they're not alone. You know, a lot of us are pretty goddamn sad right now.
Hey, folks, on this episode where we talk about a joyous time of the year, we're going to talk about horrible depression and 9/11. Stay tuned on this episode of What in the History.
I know I sound like a Debbie Downer a lot of times, but if we're talking about something that has current situation, I can relate to it. I can only relate to it as honest and as best as I can, you know? So when I think of Christmas, I know it's supposed to be this joyous, wonderful thing, but every year when I get older, it just sucks more and more out of me, drains more and more out of me.
I'm sorry. I have nowhere else to go after that, and I feel you 100%. Man, you dug us into a deep, dark pit of depression. I can't see no way out.
Hey, folks. You know what? The world keeps going, though. The world keeps spinning. It's, I don't know. Like, I'm being honest. You know, we're approaching Santa Claus. We're talking about depression. Especially, it's a rough time right now. We can't ignore the fact that so many people are struggling. And I'm sure the pressure from not being able to, let alone provide for bills, but provide presents for their children is so stressful to so many people. And my heart pulls out to them. I can't skim over this and be like, everything's great.
Since we're at this point, folks, if you're having a hard time this holiday season, call 800-273-8255. Talk to some outstanding individuals. That is the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. I have personally used it myself. If you're feeling lonely, if you're feeling sad, or if you feel like you can't make it any further, please call the number. We will include it in the episode link.
That's a perfect response to that, Dan. Thank you.
I love you all that listen to this podcast episode, to all the episodes. I love you, Johnny. and, you know, it would just hurt if one of you guys left. So please stay on. It is absolutely worth it. And even if you need somebody to talk to, I know we're podcast hosts. Reach out to What in the History on Facebook. I'm not really plugging the Facebook site. I'm just saying, if anybody listening to this needs help,
yeah, reach out, guys. We know it's tough out there for everyone right now.
Did this guy just make a pro-life statement while plugging his podcast Facebook page? Yes, I did.
Guys, if you're feeling depressed out there, if you're feeling sad, check us out at What History on our Facebook website, where we can give you a fresh podcast every week. Suicide prevention has nothing to do with that. We'll shout it out once every 6 or 7 episodes, but check us out on Facebook, guys. I love it, Dan. I'm sorry, guys, for bringing us down. Let's try and segue back to the show.
So, two of Pinter's friends in this movement to bring St. Nicholas to modern culture was Washington Irving. You know him as the man who penned Sleepy Hollow. And then this other guy who was mentioned in the intro, Clement Clark Moore. They all kind of played this role in trying to integrate St. Nicholas into society. But in 1823, Moore took this a step further. He published an account of a visit from St. Nicholas. Also published under the name 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. In this endearing poem, Moore purposely tied the arrival of St. Nicholas to Christmas Eve, which he hoped would further validate the cause of Pinter and Irving. Supposedly, Moore got his inspiration during a shopping outing in a sleigh, and he bases Santa Claus on a Dutchman who lived in Chelsea.
So this is the origin of modern day Santa, this poem or this
exactly.
Lyrics right here.
Because like you read earlier, we can see these ties of St. Nicholas into Odin and Sinterklaas, and then just kind of, you know, a few other things added. And over the years from this instance, just kind of more backstories are laid upon them. Mrs. Claus is brought into, you know, play, and then Santa's village and all that, like all that.
Yeah,
Mrs. off of this.
Mrs. Claus was put into play to push the heteronormative agenda out there. We're on to you, corporate America.
Oh, Johnny, shut the hell up. Saint Nicholas.
Why couldn't it have been Mr. Claus and Mr. Claus, equal partners?
Because this was the 1800s, Johnny.
Man, you're telling me people didn't get freaky with those thick ass mustaches back then? You're out of your minds. Those were probably
I'm sure they did.
Those were probably like coded with DNA.
I'm sure they did, Johnny. But if you were caught, you were probably killed.
Imagine having sex and your soundtrack being on the piano.
So, you know who wasn't out killing homosexuals?
Wow, that took a turn.
Saint Nicholas. He was no longer a glowering, vindictive phantom in a perpetually foul mood, but rather a jovial, dimpled-cheeked, and red-nosed old fellow with soft, shimmering eyes. Moore's interpretation of Saint Nicholas was merciful and sweet-tempered, equipped with a round belly that shook like a bowl full of jello with every note of his musical laugh. Several other passages in the poem contain vivid description of his appearance, and new details of his backstory were also disclosed. The names of St. Nicholas's reindeer, as well as his landing and docking methods, were also revealed.
You know, Dan, when I was younger, I remember having an argument on the existence of Santa Claus. And my whole argument was based on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, that lyric in the song saying, "You'll go down in history." I was like, you hear the song, it happened, he went down in history, we're still talking about Rudolph. I didn't know that Rudolph, let alone the other reindeer, were based off a lie.
Well, actually, Rudolph was created by a department store corporation, a corporate department store, in an effort to sell more items during Christmas. If you came to the store during Christmas time, your kid got this free illustrated book called Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
You know, my whole childhood is just being ripped apart this episode.
How do you think I feel, man? I'm not always dead inside, Dan, you know?
Oh, man, I'm trading places with you. The more you go on with this, the lower I'm feeling on the inside. I'm like, oh, Jesus.
So in less than 20 years, the anonymous poem freely reproduced in every newspaper in the winter season was known throughout the United States. And from there, it would spread to the rest of the English world. New Yorkers embraced Moore's homely child-centered version of Santa as if they had been doing it all their lives. Clement Clark Moore took credit for the poem years later, but some literary critics think the real author was a man named Henry Livingston, a farmer who wrote poems and published anonymously. Livingston's adult children later recalled that their father had read them those verses when they were children. There are arguments on both sides, and if you are, it's a lot. And if you're interested in checking it out and, you know, choosing to believe whatever you want, go ahead. Wikipedia, Henry Livingston, Clement Clark Moore. There are arguments for both sides, and you can develop an opinion on your own.
Can I interject with reason here?
Yeah.
Guys, if you are concerned about who wrote that poem to the point of you're going to research it, get a goddamn hobby.
Johnny, shut the hell up. Stop picking on our
listeners. Oh, my Lord. I'm not picking on our listeners, man. That's irrelevant. Henry Livingston was a farmer, and his kids, yeah, we remember him reading us that. But your kids are always going to lie about, like, I'm going to be like, yeah, my mom did that shit.
There's more evidence than that.
Oh, my Lord.
Why do you have to be such a grumpy Gus, Johnny?
I'm not grumpy.
You definitely sound grumpy. Folks, if Johnny sounds grumpy to you, please message us at What in the History Pod on Instagram and Facebook and let us know if he's being a Grinch right now. Regardless, in the decades that follow, more authors took it upon themselves to further flesh out the black story of St. Nicholas. Hey, why'd you do this? For money. In 1849, missionary and writer James Reese published a short story entitled A Christmas Legend, adding Mrs. Claus to the mix for the first time. Observant authors noted the positive reception surrounding the new character, and some of them quickly cashed in on the hype. So over the next couple years, Mrs. Claus became a reoccurring centerpiece of stories. Like I said, it was easily marketable, and people liked it.
Yeah, man, when you're adding new backstory, it's easy to put stuff that people like. Like if you got Santa, plain Santa, you can give him all of his Malibu Stacy accessories. You know, here's his reindeer. Here's his wife. Oh, 1 year special edition red nose reindeer.
So Thomas Nast was a cartoonist and caricatures. On Harper's Weekly retainer, was especially taken with Moore's take on St. Nicholas, stimulated by the varied but compelling details of St. Nicholas's backstory. Nass rolled up his sleeves and went to work on developing an interpretation of his own. His first illustration of Santa Claus was published on January 3rd, 1863, edition of Harper's Weekly. In this politically charged picture captioned Santa Claus in Camp, the Union supporting anti-Confederate Santa is clothed in a fur-trimmed coat decorated all over with white patriotic stars and striped pants bearing the colors of the American flag. Standing before Santa was a crowd of adult soldiers, one of whom is seen admiring the socks he was gifted.
I don't know how to take it. This
Nast unknowingly started a new chapter in Santa Claus history in the United States. The figure's religious ties to the original saint had been stripped away to give way to a secular character who promoted cheer, goodwill, and patriotism during the winter season. Tales popped up that President Lincoln himself had hired Nast to produce the illustration as recruitment propaganda, but regardless of how it happened, the effect it had was undeniable, and Lincoln was so impressed by the results that he called Santa, quote, the best recruiting sergeant the North ever had.
You know what I took away from all that, Dan?
What?
Santa was a pro Northern figure. So for all my libertarian listeners, Santa is anti-states rights.
But the Civil War wasn't about states' rights. It was about slavery, Johnny. The states' rights argument is just smoke.
Santa doesn't think you should be allowed to grow whatever crops you want on your land.
I'm pretty sure if we introduced Santa to edibles, he'd be pro-cannabis.
I don't know, man. I seen how it affects some people, and they get really off their game. So I don't think he could use the distraction.
So on the other side of the fight, on the wrong side, parents used a character that emphasized the oppressive strength of the Union blockade. Not even Santa could get past the darn Yankee blockade.
Now, what's this supposed to represent?
What?
What is this supposed to represent? Like, what is the imagery that it's representing? Santa's arch nemesis, but like, what is it? I don't know what the blockade is.
It's at the start of the Civil War, the Union basically lined the coastline with ships so the Confederates couldn't get any support from England and stuff like that. Plus, it also cuts off their supply lines and stuff. So basically, they would use like, oh, hey, Santa's not coming this year because of those damn Yankees. He couldn't get past that blockade. Those hating ass Yankees even hate Santa.
Hey, man, he can't get the past blockade. What chance does the fucking South have? That's the message it was really sending.
They didn't have a chance, Johnny. Nast eventually eliminated the blatantly patriotic elements in his later illustrations of Santa Claus. Santa Claus Patriotic Ensemble was retired, and it was replaced with a plain coat and pants in solid colors, along with the furry hat. He was no longer a spokesperson for the union, but once again, a gentle father figure.
It seems like that original Santa Claus spawned off into two characters after he like moved on from the Stars and Stripes and went on to be regular Santa. That image, that original image, to me sounds a lot like Uncle Sam.
Yes. Kind of, yeah. But again, he's borrowing. He was, when he first, even as a patriotic Santa, he based him off of Moore's poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas."
Okay.
So now we are going to talk about another big event in the Santa timeline in America. 3 years before the 19th century came to a close, one young girl took the initiative to seek out answers for herself. In the early weeks of September, the office of the New York Sun received a short but powerful letter from 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon. The lead editorial writer, Frances Church, was particularly moved by the O'Hanlon's inquiry. And O'Hanlon's letter and Church's response was published on September 21st, 1897. The exchange would soon break records as the most reprinted editorial of all time. So my good friend, go ahead, Johnny.
It was just a beautiful example of childhood innocence.
Right. And it captured the imagination of kids and parents all across America. And Johnny, if you will, Johnny, the resident voice actor here at What in the History, even though he has no work, just a beautiful voice, is going to read both sides of this letter. Johnny, take it away.
Yeah, I'm going to be doing the little girl. So keep in mind with that. And then I'm going to be doing Santa Claus's quote-unquote response.
Dear editor, I'm 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says, if you see it, the sun, it is so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Virginia Adeline, 115 West 95th Street.
Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They've been affected by the skepticism of the skeptical age. They do not believe that they see. They think that nothing can be which is comprehensible minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's or little. In this great universe of ours, man's is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, and compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence of capable of grasping the whole truth of knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a clause. He exists certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. And you know that they abound and give you life in its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would the world be if there was no Santa Claus? It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no children, faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment, except in sense and sight, the eternal light which childhood fills the world being extinguished. Not believing in Santa Claus, you might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is a sign. That is not a sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof if they are not there. Nobody can convince or imagine all the wonders or the unseen or the unseeable in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest men, nor the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. If fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view the picture and supernatural beauty and glory beyond, is it all real? Ah, Virginia! In all the world, there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God he lives. and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood.
And that really sprung DeSanta forward. Like, again, that was the most printed editorial of its time. It just blew up. There's movies based on it. There's books based on it. Like, it became big. It went viral, and so did Santa.
Yeah.
So now we're going to talk about the first inquiry, time a department Santa was ever used. So the origin of the mall Santas.
When did that come into play?
It all started with Scottish American businessman James Edgar. He himself was a reincarnation of Saint Nicholas. He was a kind-hearted man in a time where money ruled everything, and it was just okay to be unfair to the working class. In 1878, shortly after he relocated to Boston, Massachusetts, Edgar built from the ground up a dry goods store. It was aptly named the Boston Store, but it was later rebranded as Edgar's. Not only was Edgar a good-humored and highly spirited individual with an infectious laugh, anyone who came across Edgar, they said, benefited from his boundless generosity. Like, this guy, he cared for his working class. So, like, there's only 3 times a week where they would be open from morning to evening. He permitted employees to close up shop early in the afternoons, 4 days a week. You know, Edgar also
seemed like he was a good boss.
Yes, he also had the best interest of his customers in mind. He allowed poorer customers to place a certain numbers of items on layaway and granted a 4% monthly interest to whatever sum they could afford for the deposit. Edgar was also a fantastic neighbor. He was committed to serving his community. He regularly footed the medical bills of children in the city, all the while keeping his identity hidden.
I don't know, man. I get it, but I'm rocking with Biggie. The goddamn credit, forget it. You think a crackhead paying you back shit, forget it.
Above all, Edgar was a fun-loving and whimsical character who adored children as much as he enjoyed dressing up. Photographs preserved by loved ones and published in local newspapers show him in various costumes, from George Washington to Uncle Sam. On special occasions such as the 4th of July, he climbed up to the rooftop of the Boston store and tossed pennies and other small trinkets to the giddy crowd below. Yes.
There you go, poor people. Happiness, poor people.
Because when I think of happiness, I think of being plinked in a penny from the top of a building.
He was making it rain.
Meteorites on these hoes.
Oh, wow.
For the first few years after the opening of the Boston store, Edgar added an extra splash of color to the Christmas season by donning his favorite clown costume. He continued this self-made tradition until 1890, when he rediscovered Nass Santa Claus in an old issue of Harper's Weekly. That same afternoon, he headed downtown and employed a dressmaker to recreate Santa's costume, as seen in Nass' illustration, specifically tailored to his dimensions. Edgar later recalled the thoughts that swirled in his head, saying, "I have never been able to understand why the great gentleman lives at the North Pole. He is so far away, he's only able to see the children one day a year. He should live closer to them."
And you see how the episodes come full circle? Because in part one, we were talking about the original inspiration for Santa Claus being God of haberdashers, and this guy, carrying on his own Santa tradition, is headed down to the haberdashery.
That is a very good connection, Johnny. Thank you.
Trying to bring some type of value to this sad podcast I offer. I'm like, hey guys, Dan's gonna tell you some fun history. I'm gonna get real fucking sad. We're gonna be awkward for an hour and a half.
Hey man, There are very few people I'd rather be awkward with.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know what? If I had been said publicly to you, Dan, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, sir. Once the Santa suit was completed, Edgar returned downtown to pick up his costume. He then drew up and published a notice announcing a meet and greet with Santa Claus at the Boston store. When the day arrived, Edgar was astounded by the winding line of parents and children waiting outside the door. The unconventional entrepreneur is now affectionately remembered as the world's first department store Santa.
I'm upset with this guy. Not happy with this guy at all. Apparently in my life, I've done a lot of things. Another one of them is I played Santa Claus for about 6 years.
Yeah.
At a Christmas party. And now that I know it's because of him, he can piss off because that suit is hot and miserable.
Oh man, it's going to piss you off at the end where we talk about the money that some of the professional mall Santas make.
You know what? The biggest hang up was little kids would accidentally look up my sleeve every now and then. They would have trouble believing that Santa Claus has tattoos.
Santa Claus has jail tats, Timmy. What are you talking about?
Yeah, man. Santa Claus is hard fucking core.
By the following year, several other stores across the country had picked up on the idea, which helped bolster foot traffic and sales. Unlike many of his successors, however, Edgar never had a place to sit and idle. He roamed his store, actively seeking out children so they can confide in him.
See, now is where it gets weird. Like, I get he had good intentions, but so many people have done so much creepy shit that it just automatically gives out bad vibes.
Right. In history, the people that love the children the most usually do. So anyway, shitting on our subject today, in 1929, Captain William Winkapaw, a float plane pilot from Maine, launched a Flying Santa program in which his planes delivered gifts and care packages to lighthouse keepers and folks dwelling in isolated areas along the coast of New England. The Society's official website, Friends of the Flying Santa, described the origins of the program in further detail.
You know, that sounds an awful lot like a KKK group.
A little bit different, Johnny.
My favorite, since you bring this up of this Flying Santa promotion, my favorite image from that is there was an episode of Married with Children. They had something about like a parachuting Santa or something, and he ends up dying in their backyard.
So this program where Santa doesn't die began on December 25th, 1929. Captain Winkapaw loaded his plane with a dozen packages containing newspapers, magazines, coffee, candy, and other items. They were small luxuries and common staples that could make living on an isolated island a little more bearable. He flew to lighthouses around the Rockland area and dropped these modest gifts to the lighthouse families, never realizing just how well his gesture of Christmas goodwill would be received. He flew home to spend the rest of the day with his family.
That's nice. So he was out dropping off commissary items.
Basically, yeah, to families that couldn't get inland.
That's pretty cool. So now
the Coca-Cola company is known as the father of the modern day Santa Claus, but that is an inaccurate statement. They weren't even the first beverage company to feature Santa in their marketing campaigns. White Rock Beverages, which originated in Wisconsin, bottled fresh spring water derived from the medicinal fount near native Potawatomi settlements. And on December 19th, 1915, White Rock used Santa to push sales for the mineral water for the first time, as seen in an advertisement published by the San Francisco Examiner. In the illustration, Santa is seen behind a wheel of a tractor carrying presents neatly stacked White Rock cartons. White Rock Santa appeared in the National Herald on December 10th. You know, White Rock Santa definitely sounds like a good title for a story of a cocaine empire.
White Rock Santa. It's Barry Manilow's rock cover album.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In 1923, the White Rock Santa was featured for the first time in a color advertisement, this time in the December 12th issue of Life magazine. The Coca-Cola company cannot be credited with manufacturing the Santa known and loved by children around the world today, but the company certainly helped instill the modernized image into the minds of millions of Americans across the country. The company first tried its hand in Santa-themed advertising in the 1920s, appearing in a smattering of ads published by local newspapers such as the Saturday Evening Post. At this stage, the drink had been pigeonholed as a drink appropriate only for the summer, but the company was determined to change this. They attached the following slogan to their new campaign: "Thirst knows no season."
That's a pretty good slogan. So Coke was just for the summer.
Right. It used to be. But this first advertisement scheme fell flat. Just went absolutely nowhere. So in 1931, Haddon Sundblom, a Michigan-born illustrator, was invited on board to sketch out Coca-Cola's new and improved Santa Claus. Sundblom was instructed to create a realistic Santa as opposed to a department store Santa as featured in previous ads. Sundblom chose Clement Moore's Santa as the basis for his character, and as described in the 1927 article published by the New York Times, a standardized Santa appears to New York children. Height, weight, stature are almost exactly standardized, as are the red garments, the hood, and the white whiskers. The pack full of toys, ruddy cheeks and nose and bushy browns, and a jolly punchy effect are also inevitable parts of the requisite makeup. Sundblom also selected a live model using his close friend, a retired salesman named Lou Prentice. When Prentice died, Sundblom installed a mirror in the studio and used his own likeness as a guide for Santa's features. The artist found inspiration every which way he turned. The children seen huddled around Santa, and Sundblom's paintings were modeled after offspring of his neighbors. A mutt seen in his later work was fashioned after the gray poodle that belonged to a nearby florist. Sundblom Santa was finally unmasked in the 1931 winter issue of the Saturday Evening Post, complete with a new tagline. My hat's off to pause that refreshness.
My hat's off to pause that refreshments?
The refreshes. My hat's off to pause that refreshes. Yeah. Not.
I guess the language was different back then.
Right. Coca-Cola, let's chalk it up to that. Coca-Cola Santa continued to make reoccurring appearances in the newspaper, as well as National Geographic, The New Yorker, and the Ladies' Home Journal. Sundblom Santa was more than simply well-received by the public. It supposedly boosted the company's winter sales to perhaps even threefold. Like Coca-Cola, ambitious entrepreneurs across the country hastened to milk the most out of the secular Santa character's thriving success in the commercial world. In 1937, Charles Willis Howard, a veteran department store Santa and parade marcher who dominated the Macy's circuit, decided it was high time to refine the art. That year, he established the Charles W. Howard Santa School in New York, which remains the most senior and the most prestigious of its kind today. Obviously,
so this is like clown college.
Yes, it's Santa College, though. Obvious, This unique institution described by CBS as the Harvard of Santa schools did not earn this title and its stellar reputation overnight. Howard was a professional who took the utmost pride in his work, one determined to assemble the finest Santas the world had ever seen. To start, each student received a Santa kit, including glue on eyebrows, elastic band beard, relevant makeup, and so forth. Classes offered by the institution included the history of St. Nicholas and the secular Santas, Santa Claus, and the geography of the North Pole, as well as lectures that aimed to familiarize students with reindeer, complete with live demonstrations. Later, a separate curriculum was created for aspiring Mother Christmases.
I'm impressed by the level of work they put into it.
Oh, yeah, man. And then in January 1939, the executives at the Chicago office of Montgomery Ward, a national renowned retailer, they wanted to capitalize off this success. We already mentioned this. They brought in a man named Robert May, and they created this project to sell more product from their store. And again, this story was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. In December 1939, all 620 branches of Montgomery Ward presented to every visiting child a free copy of the 32-page fully illustrated pamphlet, which amounted close to 2.4 million copies in total. A memo published by the advertising department 2 months later explained the reasoning behind this market tactic. We believe that an exclusive story like this, aggressively advertised in our newspaper ads and circulars, can bring every store an incalculable amount of publicity and, for more important, a tremendous amount of Christmas traffic.
Okay. Okay, Dan. So their tactic was very successful. Would you agree?
Yes, very.
Okay, so then I'm going to take a page out of their book. To anyone listening, if you share our podcast, I will personally send you a illustrated 25-page book that I will draw myself. Just share our page and let me know that you did it, and I will make and send your own book. I cannot give you the quality, but it will be unique.
Stick figure Santa. And another echo of the past, Santa's face was plastered on several propaganda posters distributed across the United States during World War I and World War II. And even now today, I've seen so many photos of Santa's in like Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah, man. Kids over there got to get presents too, bro.
Yeah, man. Today, Santa Claus is bigger and more widespread than ever. The innumerable references to Kris Kringle in books, poems, movies, animations, and other forms of media and art aside, Santa Claus is commercially invincible. In 2016, the retail sector within the United States alone saw an addition of more than 700,000 seasonal jobs during the holiday. In that same year, consumers spent close to $700 billion on Christmas shopping.
Oh, yeah, man. I really, the only things I buy for people anymore are just gift cards because it's just easier, you know?
Yeah.
But as an adult, you know, you can't just buy people $10 gift cards. You know, mm-hmm. You got to give people a significant amount. And God almighty, I've been making decent money this whole month, but it just keeps going away. I finally bought the last couple gift cards I had to today. But, like, this is ridiculous. Dan, you can see the camera. The folks can't. Look at the two stacks of gift cards in my hands that I had to buy.
Wow, man.
Those are $50 a piece.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's insane. And it's like, I'm obligated because you tell people you don't want anything and then you get stuff in the mail and you're like, well, now I got to return the favor. God damn it. What do they want? I don't know. It's on Amazon. Here's a gift card.
You know who isn't struggling to buy Christmas gifts?
Top shelf paid mall Santas.
Yes, mall Santas continue to be in high demand, earning an average of anywhere between $35 and $50 an hour, or roughly $10,000 to $20,000 each season. A fraction of enterprising Santa Claus is contracted by small employers and independent agencies rake in up to $1,000 a day, serving as the entertainment for upscale parties, corporate gatherings of celebrities, and other influential figures.
You know, I thought I was selling myself short, but I guess from my experience level, I was doing pretty good, because when I was doing Santa Claus, I was getting paid $200 an hour.
Yeah, man, that's... Yeah. So that's really all I got. This is the modern influence of Santa. This is, you know, how we get from point A to point B. Point A being St. Nicholas, point B being modern American Santa. I hope you enjoyed. For those listening who didn't know, Johnny requested this episode. Johnny, did it fulfill your need for knowledge?
Yeah, man, it did. You did great research as always, yet I'm left hollow, for a lack of a better word, not because of the episode, what it lacked, but because of what I learned in the episode. It just got me more down on the whole Christmas season.
Oh, man, you got to look past. You got to look past the commercialism, because that shit sucks. But look at what Christmas represents. Look at what you can give to people. Joy and love. There's no cost on that. You can give that. You give that to me every day, and I am thankful for it. And I hope you have a Merry Christmas, Johnny.
Yeah, I'm not going to go off on a tirade. I hope you have a Merry Christmas too, Dan. You bring me much joy. Well, everybody listening, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. And I hope no matter what you celebrate, you have a happy and healthy, safe.
Right. This year is tougher than most. And I, again, if you need help, reach out. And I do hope you enjoy your time with what family you get to see or what friends. And I might also offer, if you're missing people, do a Zoom call. Do something like that. Seeing somebody's faces, albeit digitally, helps you out greatly.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I can definitely attest to that. Sometimes that's the only thing that keeps me sane.
Yeah, man. 100%. Again, if you like the episode, please follow us at What in the History Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us on YouTube. At the beginning of the year, we're having some fun and great updates coming to the podcast. So please go like our YouTube page. There's stuff coming.
Yeah, we've been steadily improving production value. I think at the beginning of the year, we are going to be all set up. And I believe the plan, if I'm correct, is to start doing episodes and putting out video for each episode as well.
Yes. Yep.
That so is we're good for there, guys.
And
well, what are we talking about next week, Dan?
Well, next week is episode 20, Johnny. We did it.
Oh yeah, we're there, man.
We are talking about the Texas Tower Sniper, Charles Whitman. He on a day in Texas, he killed 10 people from a sniper tower. It's going to be a fun episode.
I hate to sound so excited about this, but this story I've known about for a long time that it is fascinating to me. Again, guys, we're getting back into death, but I couldn't be happier to do it. Wild story. This guy was a nut, but he was an efficient nut.
Right. And even in boot camp, when we went to rifle range and stuff, they're like, yeah, the Texas Tower Sniper, he was a Marine. Learn how to shoot like that. Lee Harvey Oswald was a Marine. You know, like, just like named all these, you know, murderers in society. And they're like, yeah, you're going to learn how to shoot like that.
Not for nothing, Dan. I hope we don't ever do, because the JFK thing has been covered so goddamn much. But for anybody out there listening, you guys should know Lee Harvey Oswald was a fucking putz. Like, he was just a dim fucking idiot.
But anyway, that's enough from us. I'm Dan Brady.
I'm Johnny Smith.
and we really hope you have a great holiday season. We will be back next week.
Peace and love.
It was a moonless night. I was 18 years old. Life was going nowhere. It was midnight at the railroad tracks, miles away from anywhere. I said my dark prayer. Didn't look quite how I figured. Green suit and black hair, smile on his face, ribbons on his chest. He seemed to walk on air. He promised to get me out of this town. Some wealthy and brave. I travel the world, be powerful, but a slave until my grave. Now it's raining in the desert. Has it always gotta rain on me? I'm just another of the devil's dogs. Would they ever want with me? He grinned, I signed my name, diabolical back seal. Heard the cadence of an evil choir. Sand shifted, I fell into the pit. March with the other damned until I was one of them. But for every deal with Satan, we all face judgment daily. I was sentenced to a floating prison. Devil's dog. The abyss is changing.